Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of The Science of Murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. Today, we are continuing the discussion of the science of crime as entertainment. This is part two of my birthday month detour, where I am stepping away from the true crime world to talk about my favorite related fictional media. We're looking at why we've collectively decided that the darkest corners of the human experience are the perfect backdrop for our primetime relaxation. Essentially, we are examining the science of murder through the lens of television and movies. We're exploring how the lab and the bench have been reimagined as the ultimate objective narrators in fiction, transforming the clinical reality of forensic science into the backbone of modern pop culture. To start out, we're looking at science and criminal justice through a dual-layered narrative. There's the story the public sees, and then there is grounded reality that filters the experience for those of us who live behind the bench, or I would imagine behind the badge. It's the cartoon analogy. Just as the parent catches the subtle adult jokes hidden in Shrek, the scientist catches the clinical jokes buried in CSI. We're watching two different shows at once. While the audience is gripped by the high-stakes interrogation, we're distracted by the technical Easter eggs. There's a secret handshake involved in being a viewer who knows the trade. There's a specific quiet satisfaction in seeing a pipette held correctly or an analyzer used for its actual purpose, but that is constantly balanced against a deep clinical irritation. Nothing breaks the immersion faster than seeing a character stroll into a break room with a lab coat still on, or watching a scientist perform a complex extraction in 5 seconds without so much as a centrifuge in sight. While we groan at Bailey swabbing mountains of McConkey auger plates because she's terrified of strep bacteria, which, for the record, wouldn't even grow on that media, or roll our eyes at the instant DNA matches that pop up before the commercial break, we're still here for the same reason you are, to see justice in action. There's just a certain level of validation in just getting a mention. If Grey's Anatomy happens to spend an episode describing actual cutting-edge 3D printing breakthroughs, we're here for that too. We take the wins where we can find them. We are willing to overlook the scientific dad jokes and the clinical impossibilities because, at the end of the day, these stories are doing the one thing we care about most. They're honoring the idea that truth matters, that justice wins, and individuals are important. We are auditing the magic box of television, looking for the moments where the fiction respects the friction of the real world, and laughing at the moments where it decides that the rules of biology are merely suggestions. But mostly, we keep tuning in for the human stories. So, in my defense, I can be a salty girl. And 15 years later, I am still upset that on January 1st, 2011, the Oprah Winfrey Network replaced Discovery Health, Dr. G, Medical Examiner, Mystery Diagnosis, I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant, Untold Stories of the ER, all were totally my jam when I wasn't invading my husband's dreams with audio from my insomniac binges of Deadly Women, I Almost Got Away With It, and Dateline on an ID. For me, watching Mystery Diagnosis or Dr. G isn't a passive experience. It's a verbal defense exam. I'm giving myself 15 minutes to arrive at the truth before the show hands it to me. I'm looking at the case study, weighing the evidence, and asking, does the data support the conclusion? It's a self-administered competency test that turns the entertainment into a clinical challenge. I love it when the show wins this little side wager. Like the case of the man with unexplained heart failure whose aha moment didn't come from a cardiologist but from a friend at church who suggested a sleep study? It's those moments where the obvious medical path hits a wall, and a side quest discovery, like a snoring habit causing an enlarged heart, rewrites the entire clinical narrative. It reminds me to keep my eyes open for the variables that aren't on the standard panel. The Dr. G case that lives in my head to this day wasn't just about the science. It was about a mousetrap. A Rube Goldberg type of case. It starts with a man in a car accident. Straightforward, right? But wait, he didn't die from a car accident. The autopsy shows a ruptured aortic aneurysm. You think, okay, the aneurysm caused the crash. But that's not the cause of death either. What caused a ruptured aorta in an otherwise relatively healthy man? It turns out he had pancreatitis. The enzymes were literally leaking out and digesting his own blood vessels. Pancreatitis was the root cause of his death that ended in a car crash. How did this happen, and how did it get to this point? It turns out that it was because he was working multiple jobs to support his family. He couldn't afford to stop, couldn't afford to listen to his body, and by the time the dominoes started falling, it was already too late. It wasn't just a medical anomaly. It's a story about human survival and the failure thereof. It's entertainment mined from reality, medical anomalies, true crime, failures and successes of society. Sometimes mass media helps bring those invisible successes into the spotlight. One of the shows I followed the entire run of was Bones. I had even read some of the books that the show is based on, so I was completely interested. In the lab, we talk about data points and chemical markers, but in the field, a skeleton is basically a biological black box, much like the recorder recovered from a flight deck after a disaster, the skeleton preserves the data of a life lived and the exact mechanics of how it ended. It records the repetitive emotions of your career, the fractures of your past, and the specific signatures of the trauma that stopped the clock. If the soil is the environment of the mystery, then the bone is the witness. There's a fundamental technical reality to human remains. Truth is persistent because it's written in calcium. This persistence is what Kathy Reichs brought to the forefront. She didn't need to invent drama. She just needed to translate the records already written in the bone. When Kathy Reichs started writing Deja Dead, she was already a board-certified forensic anthropologist working real heavy cases in Montreal and North Carolina. She didn't need a second career. But there is a specific kind of frustration that comes from being a specialized expert. You see the how and why of a death clearly, but by the time that information reaches the public, it's been stripped of its technical weight. When she moved from the medical examiner's office to the page with Temperance Brennan, she wasn't just writing a thriller. She was opening the black box for the public to see. She took the forensic anthropologists out of the academic basement and showed that our work isn't just about old bones. It's about the integrity of the record. It proved that you don't need a cape to be a hero. You just need a pair of calipers, a microscope, and the grit to look at the evidence everyone is too afraid to touch. And once that box was open on the page, it was only a matter of time before the lab went prime time. She created Temperance Brennan to act as a functional illustration. She wanted to show that the forensic anthropologist isn't just a bone collector called in for a cameo. He's the one doing the grind, the measurements, the taphonomy, the painstaking work of turning a fragment of a skeleton back into a person with a history. Reichs used fiction to pull this work out of the academic basement and put the methodology front and center. It wasn't about the fame. It was about the fact that the science itself is a better storyteller than any sensationalized headline. She proved that if you just follow the evidence, the specific density of a bone or the way a blade mark is angled, the story builds itself. She wasn't trying to make herself a star. She was trying to make the process visible. When Bones hit the air and Emily Deschanel and David Boreanaz showed up on our screens, the show didn't just bring the anthropology. It brought the entire ecosystem of the lab as a forensic reality. You had the squints, the experts in entomology, geology, and chemistry, all working together in this high-tech sanctuary. And while the show certainly leaned into the ooh-shiny factor with things like the Angelatron, and instant DNA results, it did something culturally massive. It made technical competence the primary form of currency. The characters weren't fighting over who was the coolest. They were fighting over who was king of the lab. They were competing for the most accurate observation or the most concise data point. Even if the science occasionally stretched the bounds of what we can actually do in a 45-minute episode, the spirit of the work was on full display. It showcased that being the weird kid who knows everything about beetle larvae or soil composition isn't just a quirk. It's a specialized skill that brings justice to people who have been forgotten. For those of us in the actual lab, seeing that kind of expertise treated as a superpower, even a flawed one, was a game changer. It put the methodology into the living rooms of millions of people who didn't even know our professions existed. Of course, when we talk about bringing the weird kid and his special interest to the table, we have to talk about the heavy hitter, the one that changed everything. CSI. Obviously, I'm a fan. I will unashamedly fangirl over Grissom and Nick Stokes and Greg Sanders and, okay, the whole crew. And the entire franchise, because they gave science a seat at the head of the table. They turned the lab into a cathedral of logic. However, as a medical laboratory scientist, I'm also the one sitting in the dark thinking of the dead volume reality. In the science of murderous entertainment, the lab is presented as the ultimate decryption key. The criminal thinks they've obscured the truth by burning the evidence or washing away the blood, but they haven't deleted the data. They've just changed the format. The scientist's job is to take that unreadable format and translate it back into a confession. In the world of CSI, we see the magic box. You put a tiny charred fragment into a mass spec, and 30 minutes later, a 3D hologram pops up to tell you exactly where the suspect brought his specific brand of artisanal mustache wax. It's instant, it's infinite, and it's effortless. In the real lab, science has a price of admission, and it's expensive. We live by the 70% rule, where the lab provides 70% of the objective data used in medical and legal decisions. That's great. That's enormous. But we do it with finite resources. We can only process what we have. Do we have a sample? Is there enough volume? Is it clean enough sample to get usable data from? Sometimes you have to call the doctor or the detective and have a hard conversation. I have enough sample for one run. Do you want the toxicology or do you want the DNA? Which truth do you want to say? This is the pre-DNA dilemma. True stewardship sometimes means having the discipline to not run the test. It's the agonizing decision to let the sample sit in a freezer for 40 years, waiting for the technology to catch up to the crime. It's the CSI effect in reverse. The jury wants the answer now, but the scientist knows that the truth is too precious to waste on a maybe. Even with the magic box tropes and occasionally impossible 3D holograms, the legacy of these shows is massive. Juries might walk into a court expecting a pat answer in a 3K, 4K reconstruction, but for the first time in history, science is part of the discussion. The public finally understands that the most important witness in the room isn't the one on the stand, it's the one under our microscope. However, when we talk about getting the suspect on the stand or even in the interrogation room, you cannot discuss the science of murder without its progenitor, Sherlock Holmes. From the moment he stepped onto the page, he established the archetype of the high-functioning outsider. Every derivative sense from Gregory House to Sean Spencer is just a different frequency of the same signal. We see this Sherlockian DNA woven across the entire media landscape, manifesting in different ways, but always circling back to the same core principle, the objective mind as a weapon. In Elementary, we see the surgical precision of the mind. This iteration highlights that the Watson isn't just a sidekick, they are the essential social bridge. Without a Watson to translate brilliance into human, the truth is often rejected because the delivery is too cold. It reminds us that in science, as in investigation, how you communicate the data is often as important as the data itself. Then there's Sight, featuring Sean Spencer as the high kinetic Sherlock. Sean isn't psychic. He's a practitioner of environmental correlation. He notices the out of place fiber or the missing dust pattern that everyone else overlooks. He simply masks his sentinel nature with humor and hyperactivity because it makes the social gap easier to cross. He's the expert who hides his brilliance behind a bit of theater so people don't find his focus intimidating. Finally, we have HouseMD, which is the clinical manifestation of data integrity over social nicety. House's jerk persona is really just a functional low tolerance for systemic contamination. In his world, if you lie, you contaminate the data. And if the data is wrong, the patient dies. For House, being polite is a luxury that costs lives. He's the ultimate realization of the idea that the truth doesn't have a bedside manner, it just has a result. Together, these characters represent the antisocial defense of truth. They prove that sometimes, to see the world clearly, you have to be willing to stand slightly outside of it. And in many of these stories, Sherlock deals with addictions and antisocial personality traits. Sherlock's addiction isn't just a trope, it's a tool. When your brain is wired to process every micro detail, the specific mud on a boot, the tilt of a hat, the chemical residue on a cuff, the world is a high-resolution stream of data. The lab's no different. It's a sensory overload of humming analyzers, flickering monitors, and the distinct sharp smells of reagents and biohazards. Sherlock's mute button is the prototype for how many of us handle that high kinetic input. We find ways to quiet the noise so we can hear the one data point that actually matters. It's easy to love the Sherlock archetype for the cool factor, the deduction, the wit, the high kinetic brain, but there is a heavier side to this role. The refusal to be quiet when the data screams. Look, as a slightly autistic, if high functioning scientist, I get it. I hate bad data. I don't see the point in lies. And I hate lies hiding in social niceties. So, around 2009, while certain high profile figures were filling bookshelves with anecdotal accounts of a link between autism and vaccines, I wanted to know if there was any truth to the hypothesis. I decided to write my senior research paper about it. I went in with an open mind. I understood the public health necessity of herd immunity, but I was also navigating my own personal struggles with infertility and children, so I was sympathetic. I was just looking for the truth in the middle of the noise. That's when I found Andrew Wakefield. To use a phrase from True Crime's Danielle Kirstie, what this man did makes my blood boil. In 1998, he published a paper in The Lancet, one of the most prestigious journals in the world, linking the MMR vaccine to autism. Except he didn't just stumble upon an anomaly. He falsified the data. He made it all up to serve his own purposes. By the time he was found guilty of professional misconduct and his medical license was stripped, the lie had already gone global. The real tragedy of what Wakefield did is that the lie outlived the study. It outlived the retraction. Almost 3 decades later, I've mostly stopped trying to reason with the believers. You can't argue data with people who have replaced evidence with ideology. You can watch measles almost be eradicated at the turn of the century and then return to kill approximately 95,000 people in 2024. This is why characters like House resonate so deeply with those of us behind the lab bench. There's a scene where House drops the clinical detachment and tells an anti-vaxxer mother, "You know another really good business? Teeny tiny baby coffins. You can get them in frog green, fire engine red." Maybe that's why my generation, the MTV generation, is so drawn to the Sherlocks and the Houses of the world. We all grew up watching what happens when people stop being polite and start getting real. In the lab, being polite about bad data isn't a social grace. It's a systemic failure. This archetype represents the defense of data integrity over social nicety. It's the understanding that the truth doesn't care about your feelings, and it doesn't care about being civil. It only cares about the record. Because when we prioritize politeness over scientific accuracy, the result isn't just a heated debate. It's measured in tiny coffins. The reason we can't afford to be polite is that the record is the only thing standing between a society that functions and one that collapses under the weight of its own lies. We need that objective narrator. But since most people can't spend their Tuesday nights auditing clinical journals or staring at a mass spec, they look for that narrator in a different kind of ritual. They look for the social contract. If the Sherlock archetype is the defense of the raw data, then the modern procedural is the fantasy that the system knows exactly what to do with it. We move from the surgical, antisocial mind into the sprawling institutional machinery of the law. In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups: the police, who investigate crime, and the district attorneys, who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories. It's the most famous opening in the history of the genre, but it's missing the foundation. There is a third party supporting those pillars, standing in the shadows between the investigation and the prosecution. The scientists who discover and decode the evidence. If we love Sherlock and House because they stop being polite and start getting real, then we watch Law and Order because we desperately want to believe that the world can handle that reality. We want to believe in a world where justice isn't just a lucky break, but an actual social contract. The reason this show has survived for nearly 30 years isn't because of the science itself. It's because it fulfills a specific promise that the bad guy cannot hide if the data is right. It offers the boon of closure, psychological relief that even in a chaotic world, the truth can be tied up in a pretty DNA bow. It's the fantasy that the machine of justice is as persistent and objective as the people running the tests. But that primetime version of justice often ignores the actual human friction involved in the search for the truth. In the show, the detectives are unfailingly persistent, always fighting for the victim. It's a comforting narrative, but it glosses over the messy reality. In the show, the detectives follow the lead. In reality, someone might walk in with a hunch and expect a rubber stamp instead of discovery. The drama rarely depicts the paperwork wars, the jurisdictional power struggles, or the moments when a victim's story is sidelined because of a budget shortfall. By putting the investigators on a moral pedestal, the show skips over the history of coerced confessions and systemic bias that forensic science is actually supposed to protect us against. The lab is the silent partner that transitions a case from an investigation to a conviction. But it isn't a church, and it isn't a pulpit. We don't pursue this work because we are good or because we are playing God. We pursue it because science is reality. The molecules in the tube don't care about a detective's hunch or a satisfying ending for a TV script. They just are. The reason we and the audience are so obsessed with this stuff is that we're all searching for an objective narrator. Witnesses lie. Suspects lie. But the biological ledger tells the final story. We watch these shows because we refuse to accept that a boogeyman can win by simply waiting out the clock. We want to believe that the truth is a physical thing that can be measured, held, and used to balance the scales. As we glance forward, the gifted mind trope is evolving. We're moving away from the basement laboratory and into the field with the lone wolf crusaders, the modern sentinels like Coulter and Tracker or Reacher. These characters are essentially the lone wolf version of a night shift scientist. Coulter applies mechanical necessity to his searches, while Reacher applies surgical force to the tactile glitches in the system. But then you have the new heavy hitter that has my entire lab, even the non-scientists, obsessed. High potential. Morgan is the ultimate manifestation of the biological ledger in the wild. She isn't a badge. She isn't a bench scientist. She's a cleaning lady with a 160 IQ who can't help but see the data points in a pile of laundry or a cluttered crime scene. She represents that high kinetic brain we see in Sherlock, but grounded in the messy, high-stakes reality of a single mom just trying to make it to the next shift. She doesn't just see the how of a crime. She sees the logical inconsistencies and that standard investigators walk right past. She, Coulter, and Reacher are all removed, objective, and entirely focused on the data of the situation. They don't care about social niceties. They care about the result. Watching these procedurals as a scientist is a lot like watching a movie filmed in your hometown. You're constantly pointing at the screen, yelling, "The street signs are wrong," or "That's not where the hospital is." But you're still excited because, despite the errors, it's your home. You recognize the landmarks of the logic, even if the geography of the lab is all wrong. The final verdict is simple. We love the genre because it honors the persistence of truth. Being a medical laboratory scientist means living with the 42-minute lie every single day. We know the DNA doesn't run that fast, and the samples aren't always that clean. But we protect the 70% of the truth that Hollywood actually gets right. The part that says the evidence matters, the victim deserves an answer, and the record must be kept. We stay for the part of the story that makes justice possible. I'm Lissa, and this is The Science of Murder. So, today has been part two of my birthday month detour, The Science of Murder as Entertainment. Next week, we're moving back to my usual deep dives, but with a topic that is extremely mass media friendly. Cold cases. We're moving into the pre-digital fog, where evidence wasn't a clean file, but a fading Polaroid or a cardboard box forgotten in a non-climate-controlled warehouse. We'll explore how we bridge that paper gap, salvaging a single signal from degraded fragments that were never meant to survive the decades. It isn't a miracle, it's a grind. It's the science of extraction meeting administrative grit to find the one biological truth that outlasted the neglect. We're using the genetic witness network to turn these analog phantoms into high-resolution profiles, ensuring that even if the paperwork failed and witnesses have passed on, the truth doesn't have an expiration date. So, if you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into pop culture murder fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these things or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.